Hello and welcome back to the Couve's Deep Dive Podcast. I'm joined here with Simon. In the past, it's been Simon taking over the podcast. Today, I'm here and we're doing a collaboration episode to give you guys some more perspectives about a really unique topic. Why do less attractive workers earn more? Simon, do you have any thoughts on that?
This idea that the most unattractive workers earn more comes from a paper that was produced by Satoshi Kanazawa and Mary Still. Satoshi Kanazawa, just for background, was an American-Japanese author, evolutionary psychologist, who is quite a controversial evolutionary psychologist, but he mainly deals with sexual selection and assortative mating. And his perspective on these topics is basically revolves around his savannah hypothesis, in which he basically proposes that most of our evolutionary instincts are driven by the savannah principle, whereby most of our instinct, we assume, right, that we are in the savannah when we're making our decisions, which can often lead to a maladapt decision. Well, the best example of this is obviously the more sugar we eat. We really want to eat more sugar. And so in a modern environment where there's an unlimited amount of it, that's what leads to obesity.
Right. Yeah. But to the detriment of ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. But one kind of spin on this was the idea that because high intelligence, high IQ, is an evolutionarily novel trait, that those who are at that level, who are of high intelligence, these rules don't apply as much to them because basically we haven't had enough time in our evolutionary history to make these sort of rational savannah principle decisions.
So let's simplify everything so far. Human beings, we make decisions as if we're living in the savannah, which makes a lot of intuitive sense because, like you said, sugar, that's a good example. But with general mating decisions, we also, like I've always said this on the channel as well, that we are still very much not free of our biological impulses. We still behave much like animals when it comes to mating decisions. And I think the savannah principle is a great, eloquent way of describing that. But also when it comes to intelligence, which is what we're discussing here, you're saying that in the extremities of intelligence, so when we're looking at the super intelligent, the super not intelligent, we're seeing some kind of anomaly, basically. Is that?
Yeah. So in one of his papers, I believe this was, this is the one with Mary Still. He's trying to challenge the conventional hypothesis that there is a direct linear correlation between attractiveness and earnings, because of course the idea is that you get a prissy privilege or a halo effect from the fact that you're more intelligent, and that's what boosts your success in the workplace.
Right.
But what he found was, when he trolled for various things, was that actually there was a linear correlation between attractiveness and earnings, but not for one group. And that group was most unattractive, who he found actually, contrary to expectations, actually earned more than two other groups. And that those were the unattractive group and the average group.
Right.
And they actually earned a similar amount to the attractive and very attractive group.
Okay, so from my understanding, what you're saying is that there's some kind of anomaly at the upper ends and the lower ends. And what we're seeing is that you would expect the less attractive group to be earning less, but we see them to be earning more. Is it because they don't experience any halo effect at all because they're not attractive? Or is it because the higher ends of the groups experience more of the halo effect? Or is it because no one experiences the halo effect?
He completely rejects the idea of a halo effect. So he tried to test three hypotheses. One of them was that the idea that there's pure discrimination in the workplace, and that's what explains the general trends,
right,
correlation between attractiveness and earnings. And the sort of litmus test for that was that there would be a monotonically positive association between attractiveness and earnings, which of course he didn't find, because he found that the most unattractive people actually earned quite a lot. The second hypothesis he proposed was that there would be a kind of self-selective process, like occupationally. So the idea was that certain people, depending on how attractive they are, would sort themselves into different occupations according to how attractive they are, just because it would suit them more. Maybe front-facing jobs where you're having to be sociable and to show your face all the time, the attractive people would naturally gravitate towards that.
Did they control for extroversion in the study? Because it was,
I was just about to get on to that. So in the third hypothesis was that there would be no halo effect found, on the basis that once they control for things like big five personality traits, intelligence, health, height, all of these things, that there actually wouldn't, that relationship would no longer exist. And basically that is what they found. They found that once they controlled for all of these things, which very few studies had done prior, they found that their looks had no significant effect on your earnings.
Okay, this actually ties into the next study, which is facial appearance affects science communication. And one of the findings was that they found that people of the public would trust interesting looking scientists, interesting looking, obviously code for less attractive scientists, more than they'd trust attractive scientists. And I don't know if you saw the movie Don't Look Up. Have you seen that? Have you heard of it?
It came out recently
and it was a we has Leonardo DiCaprio in it, and it's a parody of how science communication works. You know, when scientists are talking about climate change, they come on TV, they talk about climate change, a very serious issue, but then all of media like Twitter and Instagram, they pick up on the looks of the scientists, right? So obviously Leonardo DiCaprio was playing the scientist, and all they would talk about is the hot scientist guy, forgetting the message completely. And this is very much this is quite the anecdote to that. We're less attractive scientists, we expect them to be more trustworthy because of this idea of assortative mating, where you're a scientist, you chose that profession for a reason, probably because you not only are you smarter, but because you enjoy that introverted lifestyle. So you'd expect them to know what they're doing.
Yeah, what they found in this study, which is most interesting, was portrayed in that film, which is that the more attractive scientists had a lot more initial interest in their work. Whereas, so that's obviously useful for science communication or for popular science.
But you would trust them less.
They would be initially more interested in their work. But then when it came to actually evaluating the work itself, they would actually rate the work of the unattractive scientist.
Yeah, I'm very much at fault of this as well. I think, have you ever done this? Because I've judged people by their looks and then said, oh, what would he or she know about science when you see somebody else? I'm very much at fault of this.
I think I am as well. And I guess one of the points of Satoshi Kanazawa, when he says that his explanation for there being that association between looks and earnings is that basically people who are better looking are actually more intelligent and more extroverted and all of these things.
Right.
Now that's actually, I think that is quite questionable.
Quite a controversial topic.
It is very controversial. And it's based on quite a sort of flimsy assumption, which is that in societies, when you have assortative mating, you have the high status men. And because they're high status, because they earn a lot of money, they're able to basically have a choice of which women they have children with. And that's invariably going to be the most attractive. But then when you look at another study he's done, the way he explains why the most unattractive people earn a lot of money was that the most intelligent people, because they don't follow the Savannah principle, they don't care about looks as much. They maybe have other means with which to choose which partner to be with. And the point he was trying to make was this association.
So just going back before we lose the point, you mentioned that the highest status men choose invariably the most attractive women. Does that mean, so then where does the idea of intelligence and attractiveness come from? Is that purely from the halo effect, that the most attractive women are also perceived to be the most intelligent, or are they actually some of the most intelligent as well? Because of, again, assortative mating 1,000 generations ago.
I think the idea is that the highest status men are the most intelligent. So I think there's the correlation between wealth and intelligence.
I would agree with that too. Even though it's a very much, the left really enjoys bringing down some of the super wealthy. And I don't understand this simping for the super wealthy, but they are undoubtedly smarter than the average person. And that's without a doubt. It takes a certain level of skill to start your own enterprise and to make it successful, especially when 90% of businesses fail within the first year. There is definitely intelligence to it.
I think it's very easy to mistake not perfect meritocracy with no meritocracy at all.
100%.
I think there could be a better association between talent and money, because obviously billionaires are just getting wealthier from the fact that they're clearly manipulating stocks or whatever.
But at one point they weren't a billionaire. At one point they did have to do. For some people coming from a wealthier background, Elon Musk, he came from an apartheid family. He had a better chance, but there was still a point where he had nothing, relatively nothing. And it still takes a level of intelligence. I would agree with that. But then then the argument that most successful men choose the most attractive women, and from that we're getting intelligence, I think that's, again, a very flimsy hypothesis.
Yeah, and that also leads us on to asking the question of why the most unattractive people buck this trend. Obviously, Satoshi Kanazawa's explanation was that he paired up, he looked at the data and he saw that the most unattractive people marry more, and the people they tend to marry also tend to be more intelligent. And so his explanation was that intelligent people go for unattractive people because they don't care about that.
Yeah.
But actually, I think there are a few nuances there. And first is that one of the things he found was that there was a lot of disagreement over who was in the most unattractive category. So basically, for the other categories, the unattractive, average, attractive, and very attractive, there was generally quite a lot of agreement by participants over who was in that category. But for the most unattractive, there seemed to be quite a lot more variance. And so you could argue that even though I also subscribe to the view that beauty and attractiveness is about 80% objective and 20% subjective, but I think you could argue that for the most unattractive people, it's more like 50-50.
Yeah, I would actually liken that to the familiarity effect. When you haven't seen a whole lot of people that are in the extreme ends of unattractive or attractive, you have no yardstick of measuring their attractiveness objectively by.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And also, as you discussed with JC the Catalyst in a video last week, the margins between being an incredibly attractive Hollywood film star like Brad Pitt and being his brother. His brother's not bad looking, but it is like really tiny margins that, you know.
Yeah, a couple of millimeters of facial structure and it makes all the difference.
That's all it is. So you could argue that for the most unattractive people, it is usually a facial deformity that puts them there. But for some people, that facial deformity might be more forgivable. And they might look at the face more holistically than others. And it is more subject to individual interpretation.
Yeah, no, we see this with a lot of different things as well. It's not just attractiveness that you see these weird anomalies at the far ends of the extremes. You see this with everything in physical science, like electrical readings. You see a lot of noise at the extreme ends. There's a lot of examples like this. So it doesn't surprise me, but the idea that when you get to the far ends of the looks spectrum, you would trust them more, that's a really novel take.
Yeah, and I think there's one other thing to say about the most unattractive people. And I think it's a cliche at this point, but there is something to be said about the idea that the most unattractive people are out of the rat race from a very early age. And particularly if their facial unattractiveness is caused by, say, a deformity or whatever, they're going to intuit from a very young age. They are not treated as well as other people, particularly if they have a more attractive siblings. And I think as a result of that, I think they are going to benefit in some ways because they are going to find another niche in which they can.
Exactly. No, exactly. 100%.
Fulfillment out. And I think that could be behind the anomaly that shows that they actually do earn quite a lot despite being quite unattractive.
Yeah, I completely agree with that because what's true is that when you see somebody that's really unattractive, and I was saying this in the video on the one with Cut where everyone rated themselves 7 out of 10, in a truly meritocratic society, not everyone should be pursuing the goal of being the physically attractive statues and models and modelers. And I think Greek society was a good role model for what society, a successful society might look like, where they had people who were sophists, I think that's the word, who were trained in the art of argument and law. And then there were people who were philosophers, there were people who were in academia, and then there were people who made it their whole life goal to be statues for the likes of other artists. So not everyone should pursue the goal of being physically desirable. Actually, maybe not desirable is the right word, but physically attractive. Rather, you should still want to be desirable for mate selection. But the fact that we go through all of these associations when we see somebody that's less attractive, my mind would go to, oh, he's less attractive, so therefore he spent more time studying, therefore he's going to be a better scientist, therefore I would trust him to be my doctor more than Mr. Handsome Chad dude.
Yeah.
So the fact that we go through all of these associations in a split second is fascinating.
Yeah, and I think it leads into a broader question about why there is such a huge variance in how human faces look and why facial attractiveness conforms to a normal distribution in the same way that, say, height does or IQ. For reference, a normal distribution is basically
for those bell who don't curve. Know,
Exactly. It's like a bell curve. So most people converge around the mean and the average.
And because of the central tendency theorem, generally everything in every physical aspect of anything, if you add enough data points to it, it will all converge to this one shape.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just interesting to consider why that is. Like, clearly it is more difficult to attain the higher end of that spectrum, like the higher end of physical attractiveness or IQ or whatever, because they're such polygenic traits, i.e. there are so many thousands of genes contributing to all of these traits. And that's the same with height as well.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to get to either end of the spectrum. But then you wonder as well, at the other end of the spectrum, where you get members of the population who are a very low IQ or very low in attractiveness, you wonder if there is a kind of, evolutionary advantage to that, either on an individual level or...
I think there was some kind of, I do remember a very vague paper that people of lower IQ are given more preferential treatment. Then there are people of extreme levels of neoteny given more preferential treatment, extreme levels of unattractiveness given more preferential treatment. You might feel pity for them or sorry for them.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine that being a selective pressure for making a face deliberately unattractive over the risk of not being able to find a partner. It seems like a very big gamble.
It does. But then again, one of Kanazawa's paper did show that unattractive people are more likely to marry. And that does seem like it would be good for their fitness. But then again, I don't know if that is just a product of the modern world in which the most attractive people simply won't settle down. And we discussed this with Robin in the video, or whether that is something that's universal. And I do wonder about that sometimes.
In one of the earlier episodes, I made a podcast. The topic was the fear of being single. That was higher in more attractive individuals than in less attractive individuals. So less attractive individuals, they're fine with dying alone. They've come to terms with it. But with more attractive individuals, like you look at the Love Island types, you know, they can't go without being with a partner, without a partner for like 10 seconds. And so because of that, you would expect that when you're in the lower ends of attractiveness, their standards not only are more realistic, but also it's easier for them to find a partner because they're not attached to the idea of being with someone.
That's an interesting one.
Because it directly answers your question on why more attractive people would think this way.
Yeah. But anyway, we're moving on for the map back to the other paper on science communication and how seriously people are treated. I think we can't, just because of Kanazawa's results, we still don't think we can write off attractiveness and how important it is. Because I think one of the findings of this paper was that the attractiveness of the scientists in question was actually found to be more important than things like gender and race, which still had an effect on how seriously people are taken. So for example, female scientists are taken less seriously, and maybe this is on the basis that they're seen as less innovative or intelligent or whatever other stereotype exists. But interestingly, ethnic minority scientists were actually taken more seriously. There's an equivalence between them and less attractive scientists.
Oh, okay.
Less attractive, actually, because while there may be less initial interest in their work, their results are still trusted.
Gotcha. Okay. I would say this is more so social, because with ethnic families, there's this greater pressure on STEM subjects over in humanities. When you see something like this, you're like, oh, they might know what they're talking about, because there's this greater emphasis on education and academia from a really young age. I think this might just be more social. I can't imagine there's a biological reason for this.
But then I've got to ask, why do we find that same effect with unattractive people? Why do we assume that unattractive people are going to be more competent as well? And then that sort of goes back to what I was talking about earlier with unattractive people and finding a niche, like going into a profession that is quite onerous and requires a lot of work. It requires a lot of conscientious effort. Yeah.
Like you wouldn't want your doctor to be thinking about entering a modeling show. You'd want them focusing on the books.
Yeah, exactly. It's just interesting that we expect unattractive scientists to be better for that reason. I think we've had that effect in the UK. We had the chief medical scientist for the government was a guy, what's his name? Chris Whitty. And a lot of people did make fun of his appearance, but I also think, weirdly enough, that made people trust his judgment more.
Yeah.
When the government were making pronouncements on what kind of COVID policies they were going to follow, our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, was actually more of an assistant to Chris Whitty, just because I think Chris Whitty represent the archetype of the diligent scientist.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if his look...
No, 100%, especially when you're going on any kind of live media platform, any kind of TV, a televised platform, you have to remember that the scientist is more akin to a talk show host or like weather anchor, right? And that's why the effect of looks... attractiveness, being an attractive scientist, helps in communication in those platforms, but then you trust them less, because just like you wouldn't expect a weather anchor to tell you about something that's not in their field, it's the same idea. So when you see somebody that's attractive, you assume that their field is in being attractive. Their field isn't in science. Science is their day job. The other way around. Being attractive is their day job. Science is like their hobby, right? But when you see somebody that's less attractive, their day job is doing science, because what else are they going to be doing? it's the same idea.
Yeah. There was another thing I noticed from the Kanazawa paper, and that was that there actually is like a tiny correlation between attractiveness and intelligence. And I was just wondering, it's only like a 0.15 correlation.
I'd say it's too small to be significant.
Yeah, no, it probably is too small. But I think I was wondering that even if it is too small to be significant, it still could be significant in people's minds. And that's maybe why there is such thing as a halo effect. Because even if there is no significant correlation, I think humans, whether it's rational or irrational, we are trained, we are evolved to spot patterns, like we are pattern seekers. Yeah. And I think that's potentially one explanation as to why there's such a huge variance in how our faces look. Other animals, they look obviously to us quite similar. And the only way they can distinguish between who's higher up in any hierarchy is through if they win fights or their baboon's rear end is more red.
On that topic, I actually can answer this. So I've read a couple of books so Dr. Weston Price had this theory in one of his books. I can't remember the name, but he basically proposed that the divergence in our facial aesthetics as modern Westerners is because of our diets. Whereas if you look at indigenous populations who rely on traditional diets, their faces are almost one-to-one with each other. They could come from a different mother, brother, whatever, but they all look very similar because they all reach their full genetic potential through proper dentition, proper chewing patterns, masticatory patterns. And because of those reasons, they all look the same. They reach their full, that balloon of genetic potential is fully blown up. Whereas with Westerners, you don't see that. Some get their genetic potential filled, some don't make it, some have poor breathing patterns and it leads to facial development being poor.
I think there is certainly something to that, but I also think it's quite difficult to make generalizations from modern hunter-gatherer groups just because the reason they are still hunter-gatherers is because usually they're quite geographically isolated.
So that's what I was thinking as well, yeah.
So most of the horticulturalists or hunter-gatherers that still exist are mostly in places like the Amazon rainforest where they couldn't be reached by modern civilization. So I suspect it might also be to do with their
genetic inbreeding.
Yeah, more to do with their smaller gene pool. But also potentially, I think the reason why we have such differentiation in looks and why we're able to judge people so quickly, like we're literally within 33 milliseconds, we can judge whether someone is threatening or whether they're dominant or whether they're kind or just whether they're attractive. The reason we can do that is because we have this pattern seeking behavior. We can see tiny correlations and they don't really have to be significant at all. Just these 0.1 correlations that
are
all
and most of the time they're not even rational. They're quite irrational.
They're not rational.
Especially like the 0.15 you just mentioned.
Yeah. And the thing is the adaptive doesn't have to be rational. And that's the sort of beauty of it. Because we're evolved to see these patterns everywhere so we can make these first impressions so that we can be careful and hedge against any malign activities from the other individual. We still see these correlations and we still make these judgments if they're not significant.
No, that's like one of the greatest cases of fake it till you make it. We believe they're irrational until it becomes rational.
Yeah, exactly. So all these things like the eyes being too close to one another, we assume aggression just from that, even if there's nothing particularly significant about it. I mean, there obviously are some correlations that do matter. One of my favorite videos on the channel is about dark triad traits and how they can be seen in the face. But I think there's actually a mechanism to explain that, and that is high testosterone, which can have effects on both behavior, the big five personality, and on facial development. So I think there is something to that. But I think for most things, you're right, it is insignificant and it is irrational, but it's still adaptive. And I think that's basically why we get that. We get that normal distribution, but it's also why you get so much variation within that and why there's also a good deal of subjectivity to attractiveness, even if it is mostly objective.
Actually, speaking on the dark triad, that video, a lot of people called it phrenology, believing that the association between your physical characteristics and personality traits is purely phrenology. But there are mechanisms, there are actual physical mechanisms, biochemistry mechanisms that can still lead to these ideas. And so it's hard to close the book on this topic entirely without discussing all the possible avenues.
Yeah, and I find it ridiculous that this sort of people bring up the E word, eugenics. I think they just fail to understand that there is a difference between what is adaptive and what is eugenic. When people like Kanazawa are talking about this, and when they're talking about his idea that intelligent people are going to be more attractive because that's how hypergamy works and that's how associative mating works, people attach like value judgments to that when there is no value judgment to be attached. Like it doesn't matter. There is no such thing.
A lot of it is just personal self-esteem. You say one thing is adaptively worse for this environment than another, people take it as a personal insult to their character. It's just a lot of it is just social issues, and you have to try to navigate all around it. But anyway, we're going to try to wrap this one up. Thank you everyone for joining me and Simon today. If you guys enjoyed this episode, then be sure to subscribe to the Patreon, and I'll catch you all in the next one with Simon again next week.